Hello again. We have the second part of a series that we started last week, and our guest is Scott Stevens. In case you missed it last week, you got to go back and listen to it, but I'll tell you the bio now again for the people who are just tuning in. Scott Stevens is an award-winning journalist and international presenter talking about addiction and especially alcohol addiction. And his book is called Look What Dragged the Cat In. And the book is about the opioid crisis. And so last week I told you that we were going to use Benjamin Franklin's method of making a decision, especially a difficult decision. And that method includes making a T-chart. So if you've got your T-chart from last week, bring it out. If not, while we're getting started, take a sheet of paper, put a line down the center and a line across the top. Put the question across the top, should I drink alcohol? Question mark. And on the left side, put risk, R-I-S-K-S. And on the right side, put benefits. And we're going to start listing, as you're listening to the program, the risk and the benefits of drinking alcohol. And you'll see by the time that we get to the end of this series that probably no rational individual who isn't already addicted would answer it, yes, I should drink alcohol. And if you are addicted to it, I want you to go over to Amazon and get a copy of my book, Freedom from Addiction, number 3. And in that book, you can break away from your alcohol addiction, which, of course, is a more serious problem than just a person that takes an occasional social drink. On my side, I put risk, number one, gateway drug. Number two, increases the risk of using opioids and other drugs. And over on the benefit side, and we will at a later date talk about how much of a benefit this is, but number one, a social lubricant. And number two, a stress reliever. And number three, a self-medication way to relieve pain. Now, if you want to put down, you can do that. Or if you have something better, you can put that down. And then as we go along today in this part two of this series, you go ahead and add the risk you hear and the benefits. Scott, it's so nice to have you on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me back, Wynn. I was thinking about it and preparing for a program today, and I was thinking about those pluses, you know, on the side of the Franklin decision chart there. And as I was prepping for the show, I'm thinking, okay, you know, the social lubricant part, all of that ties into the nature of this drug being a central nervous system depressant. And it is an effective, somewhat effective central nervous system depressant in that it does help people with anxiety and social anxiety and those sorts of things. But as you pointed out in your intro here, we're going to get into some of the other side of that chart that are going to just make those minor pluses look pretty minuscule.
Right. Well, I put that down because if you need a social lubricant, then that indicates to me that you have a low self-esteem and you need something else other than your own value of your worth to be able to get through social situations. And I can talk about later what you want to do to increase your self-esteem. And the second one, it relieves stress. It does, but at what cost? So,
exactly.
You know, and as far as self-medication for pain, that's how a lot of people get hooked on alcohol. Back in the Civil War, they gave people alcohol so that they could cut their leg off. But,
yeah. You
know, it's not the way I would want to medicate pain these days. So you can put them down and you can think about them.
Mm-hmm.
Them off if you want to or whatever, but I put them on my list. So now let's
Certainly. Get
back into the interview. We
okay.
got up to the point that we were talking about opioids, and we had gone over a number of things about opioids and describing them and telling about the risk of overdose. And I think probably opioids are killing about 5 Americans a day. And that's a lot of families that are being disrupted and torn apart by this one particular issue. So now, some people have said the way to solve this problem is to buy more Narcan and give it to people. Now, why don't you, Scott, tell our audience what Narcan is, what it does, and why this is a kind of a flawed way of treating the problem.
Well, that's we could spend a couple of shows talking about this one, because Narcan is a very, very interesting response to cleaning up this opioid mess here. What the drug does, what Narcan enables first responders to do, is to revive a person who is dead, who has died from an opioid overdose. You know, obviously it's going to be effective within a few minutes of the overdose happening. When they're gone, you can bring somebody back to life. It sounds like a miracle here, but really what it is it counteracts the effect of that opioid in suppressing the vital signs, vital systems of the body. And I think that everybody's seen like a doctor show where they pump adrenaline directly into somebody's heart and it revives them after dying. Well, this is very similar. It's administered nasally or injected, and it has the ability to bring back somebody to life. Now, I have been on both sides of this conversation here about Narcan as a response to the opioid crisis. At first, I was in the camp, firmly in the camp, where I believe it's extremely poor public health policy to subsidize recklessness. In that, here somebody has done something, they've overdosed on a drug, and we're bringing them back, we're giving them a way out. But, you know, that's a hard line. I think from a public health policy standpoint, there's validity into it. I know where I was coming when I was where I was at that time. But you know what? If you've ever held somebody who's dying or dead in your arms, you know you give your last dollar, your last breath to bring that person back to life. And that is what Narcan does. It brings them back for a second chance. For addiction professionals like yourself, I mean, that means it's an opportunity to get them into treatment. And by God, you know, if you have that opportunity, you can't bring a corpse to treatment. You just can't. So here's an opportunity to address the addiction problem that this person is facing. Now, that being said, in the United States, only 1 in 3 people who are administered Narcan are taken directly to treatment. That leaves 2 out of the 3 to their own devices, and clearly they weren't that great. The mind under the influence is going to make some pretty terrible decisions. In my own work experience here, I've got 2 people who have been Narcan'd twice in the same weekend. And, you know, so they're still struggling with what got them to the precipice of death anyway. And if we're not seizing that moment, if we're administering Narcan and and bringing them back and not seizing that moment to say, hey, this is how we can address this, then we've missed the opportunity.
Well, from my perspective, I can't do anything with an addict that doesn't want to get well. And, you know, if you keep overdosing on Narcan day after day, week after week, it sort of indicates to me that they don't want to get well. So my program, nor anybody else's program, is going to help that individual. So that's something that you have to think about. And so I was thinking in Ben Franklin's thing, risk benefits, what is the risk of drinking alcohol when you combine it with a situation where a person is clinically dead and has to have Narcan? Is there anything we can say about that?
I'm not certain that there's anything that we can say about that. The Narcan conversation is definitely part of the overall opioid dialogue. If we look at the effectiveness of any drug combined with alcohol, I think that there may be the presence of alcohol in the system as an additional suppressant to the respiratory system that could come into play. But I don't know of any clinical studies that say yay or nay on that, that if the person OD'd and has alcohol in their system, that it's going to counteract the effectiveness of Narcan.
Yes. Well, alcohol can kill you by the same mechanism, I guess, that opioids do. And it just is something to keep in the back of your mind, that if you're pushing a lot of alcohol into your body and you're depressing your systems, and then you go and shoot up with an opioid, which also depresses your system, you got twice as much chance of not surviving the situation, perhaps. Something.
I think that's spot on. And, you know, when we look at the idea of overdosing on alcohol, some people would call it alcohol poisoning, but essentially it's an overdose. You're taking too much of a drug, and it shuts you down. And six people a day die in the United States still today as a result of drinking too much too fast, and their body shuts down on them. So alcohol overdose is a very real thing. We kind of commonly associate it with binge drinking and college-age kids, but adults can do, more mature adults can do the same thing. This is a drug that your body doesn't respond well to, and the more you put this drug into your system to suppress your respiratory and cardiovascular systems, the outcome isn't going to be great.
So on my side, under risk, should I drink alcohol, I put increases deaths from overdose.
Correct.
Now, okay. Now, let's see. Someone said an ounce of prevention is worth a stack of treatment dollars. I think that was you.
No, I think that was me, but I did steal something from Franklin on that one as well. You know, the idea of prevention is something that we don't pay particular amount of attention to when it comes to this drug. And, you know, I look at the prevention methods that are put into place for smoking, for example, and this is a big highlight in Look What Dragged the Cat In. We've done very, very effective smoking prevention so far with our young people. It may have taken a step back with this vaping phenom, but by and large, we've made great strides in preventing smoking by education. And boy, we can make the same kind of inroads with this particular drug if we get smarter and start earlier with our youth. We can prevent a lot of these things that are on the negative side of the chart from becoming a reality for many families in the United States.
Well, I hope that our program does that, but I was wondering, why do you think that it was, that this was able to happen with tobacco, but up till now, it hasn't happened very much with alcohol?
The timeline, if we look at that, in 1964 is when the Surgeon General produced his first report on smoking to say, hey, smoking's bad, knock it off. And we didn't have the internet then. Al Gore hadn't invented it yet. So it took generations to get that message down to every common person in the United States here. When I look at the big catalyst here in the 80s, we had finally cut down or eliminated smoking on airplanes because, hey, smoking with 140 other people in a sealed tube is not a great health extending plan here. And then in the 90s, the phenomenon of secondhand smoke became much more widely publicized. And then in 97, we had the Master Tobacco Settlement, and boom, we're off to the races. We eliminated advertising of smoking for the most part. We still see it out there in some neighborhoods, and they're addressing that as well. We banned public or smoking in public places like restaurants and taverns, and we began to educate kids all the way down to the kindergarten and pre-kindergarten levels regarding the dangers of smoking. We said, hey, this isn't glamorous or hip or cool or sexy. This is a killer. Now, in 1997, our Surgeon General came out with his first ever report to say, hey, these are the dangers of consuming alcohol. Now, in my opinion, and in my fourth book I wrote about this, my fourth book being I Can't See the Forest with All These Damn Trees in the Way, I write about, hey, this is a good start, but he didn't go far enough. Now, granted, our government is sort of beholden to the alcohol industry because it's so large and such a huge contributor. However, we've got the first report out there. I think we're at the front end of a sea change where people are going to start educating. And we've seen it. The links to cancer are being promoted more when it's in the dialogue of alcohol. We're going to need to begin to take that same formula of educating kids all the way down to the kindergarten and pre-kindergarten level to say, hey, look, alcohol isn't cool or sexy or hip. It is a killer. It's the number three cause of death in the United States, cause of preventable death. Come on.
Well, I'm thinking maybe the reason that alcohol hasn't taken off like tobacco has with changing the Americans' thoughts on this subject comes down to another addictive behavior. And that addictive behavior is greed.
Mm-hmm.
Makes a lot of money for a lot of people.
And so did tobacco. And this is where I've gone into quite a bit of, I'll say, heated dialogue with a few people because they say, well, if we stop advertising alcohol or if we cut down American alcohol consumption, what's that going to do to this major industry in the United States? Well, guess what? We did that to tobacco, and so far as I can tell, the tobacco industry, big tobacco, is still fat and happy. They haven't lost revenue, even after paying billions to settle the Master Tobacco Settlement and experiencing a reduction of tobacco use here in the United States. The other half of this greed equation is governmental, legislative. I mean, we've decided to balance our budgets in many states and municipalities on increased alcohol tax or sin tax. We felt, we being the collective we, our elected officials felt that, hey, you know, here's a reliable, steady stream of income because we know people are always going to drink. Because we haven't discouraged them from it, despite the health consequences and health risks of even moderate drinking. So we'll balance our budget with an increase in the alcohol tax. And you know, the notion of a sin tax is really basically put the government in contradiction because the government is supposed to be protecting its citizens, and at the same time we're saying, but, you know, we kind of need this tax revenue at the same time. And topic of greed, we can continue on with the legislators themselves. The tobacco lobby is a very, very wealthy, very, very well-funded organization that contributes to a lot of campaigns. And being reelected is important to officials. The final part of this is greed on the part of the mainstream media. The mainstream media, if you look at network television, for example, the largest revenue generator in broadcast media is broadcast sports. Well, if we turn around and say broadcast sports, you can no longer accept advertising dollars from the alcohol industry, boom, you've just cut off a major source of their revenue for that news operation, or for that broadcast operation. So is the news operation going to slay the golden goose that keeps the broadcast network on the air? I don't think so. So there is a, greed does, you're right, Wynn, that it does play a tremendous part in the whole shift of the dialogue regarding alcohol.
Well, from my point of view, since greed is just one of the addictive behaviors, and I've identified over 30, that a lot more people in the United States need to get over the larger disease of addiction as opposed to getting over a particular single behavior. And we know that if a person is able, for one reason or the other, to stop doing something that's bad for them, they quite often go to another one of the addictive behaviors. So, I mean, I would like to see that happen. I don't see it happening very, very fast. Okay. There are some other things that people have proposed to take care of the opioid crisis, and that's Suboxone and methadone. Would you give us a brief overview of how that helps?
What we're talking about is a category called MAT, medication-assisted treatment, where the person who is struggling with cravings or struggling with returning to their addiction because they seek that high, they're given a managed dose, managed by a physician, distributed by the physician, taken usually orally in liquid form if it's available, to manage the cravings while this person experiences the rewiring of their brain to live without this drug and to rewire their life, to get away from the people, places, and things that have been in their life that they continue to associate with the use of opioids. So Suboxone and methadone, both of them are a key component to medication-assisted treatment. What they are, Suboxone serves as an opioid channel blocker. So if somebody takes an opiate while they're on this drug, they're not going to feel the effects. They're not going to get the high that they have the expectation that they're going to feel. So they've negated the reason for smoking or injecting anyway because they're not going to get the high. What this has done, though, and we're in a situation right now where this opioid crisis has created a shadow crisis of other drugs because the person, the patient, the client, the human being still wants to experience a high. So we've seen a resurgence behind this of people taking cocaine and people taking benzodiazepines or back to meth again, like we experienced in the 1990s and early part of 2000s, because those drugs don't, when you take those drugs and you're on medication-assisted treatment, you still get the high. They're not in the class of opiates, so their opioid channel blocker is ineffective, and people are, we're seeing shadow crises behind the crisis we're trying to fix with Suboxone and methadone.
Okay, so that's some background for y'all on another way of trying to influence this crisis. So, next question. Where does the use of marijuana fit into the current drug crisis picture?
It has been suggested that legalizing marijuana for a recreational purpose would discourage people from getting their high elsewhere, specifically opioids. And they say, well, you know, if you would have just legalized it, legalized our weed for recreational use, we wouldn't have this problem. And they point to Colorado. Colorado is often held out as the shining example of all the great, wonderful things that can help, that can come from legalizing a presently illicit drug. Well, the facts don't really bear that out. Their number of opioid-related deaths have not gone down as a result of legalizing recreational marijuana in the state of Colorado. As an aside to this, their tax revenue that they're collecting from legalized recreational marijuana is nearly keeping up with the medical expense associated with recreational use. But to the point you made, the connection is often made by those eager to legalize recreational marijuana is that, you know, this is a substance where if somebody wants to get high, and the pro-marijuana forces will continue to pound the drum to say, hey, this is harmless. It doesn't kill people the way opioids do. Why not legalize it? It doesn't kill people the way alcohol does, for that matter. Why not legalize it? And that's a crummy, you know, that's like saying, well, the people on the back of the Titanic died later than the people on the front of the Titanic, so it's all good. It's all good. And it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's a real non-starter for me. On the other half of the equation, though, Wynn, is that there are pain-relieving properties to medicinal use of marijuana or to other components within the marijuana plant. We see advertisements all the time where I live, and I'm sure it's coast to coast for CBD or cannabidiol, which is a component of marijuana that has been touted to have some healing properties or some pain relief properties. I think it needs to be studied, but if there is a medical use, and I say there is. I say there is. I'm not against medical use of marijuana at all, but, you know, we need to explore it further. We need to make it more available. If it is a very effective pain reliever, let's put it in a clinical environment. If those things bear out to the standards of what we can prove to the Food and Drug Administration.
Okay. Let's talk about why alcohol is the gateway drug to opioid use. What's the relationship there?
For people using illicit drugs, this is a center, or American Addiction Center's study that was done in 2018. For people who are using illicit drugs, two-thirds of them point to their first drug as alcohol. So there's a straight line right there for two-thirds of the opioid users. Two-thirds, two out of three, go right to alcohol as their first drug. That is the gateway. Now, as I continue in Look What Dragged the Cat In, where did all of us, illicit drug users, non-drug users, where do we learn to self-prescribe? We learn it from alcohol. We have dad come home from work, has one beer. He normally has one. Well, today was a rough day, so he's going to prescribe himself a second or a third or a sixth dose of that drug because that is our experience. We witness it. It's advertised to us. Find me a beer advertisement that has just one beer in it. We have been groomed to self-prescribe through alcohol advertisements and through the way that alcohol is used in dosage around our communities and around, frankly, around our own tables at home, in many homes.
Yes, yes. Okay. The economic impact of drinking, $250 billion dollars each and every year. Alcohol revenue taxes don't cover the economic damage caused by alcohol. And a point that you made in your book, there is an alcohol-related hospital admission in the country every 30 seconds. So I guess what I'm saying there is the revenues that alcohol brings in doesn't nearly take care of the problems that alcohol causes.
Not even close. At $250 billion a year, that's an economy the size of Norway. So we're looking at a massive number year in, year out. Mr. Trump could build 50 walls for what they're talking about here. That's a lot of money. And the lion's share of this is in lost productivity, because if a person is drinking or hungover, they show up without their A game, and there's this myth out there called a functional alcoholic. None of us are functional when we're under the influence of this drug or any other one. But with lost productivity, you show up late, you're not working as productively as before, if you show up at all. And that comes to the bottom line that every single one of us faces when we're at the Winn-Dixie or the Walmart buying our goods and services, because it's all going to cost more as a result of the use of this drug. It's a pretty astounding number when you look at over 320 million people in the United States. That's enough money to buy every single one of them, man, woman, and child, a 65-inch high-definition 4K TV every single year. So we're bleeding money when it comes to alcohol use. And it's not just the alcoholic use. It is the so-called moderate or responsible use of alcohol. All adds up to this pretty astounding number. I'm glad you brought up the hospital visits, too, because here's another economic decision that is going on in the United States. It started several presidents ago when we talked about universal health care. Well, a major driver of health care costs in the United States is alcohol-related illness. When you look at the ties to cancer and to osteoporosis, to early onset dementia, you know, these are all things that require hospitalization and usage of doctors' time here in the United States. When 20 to 40% of the hospital beds in the United States are going to treat alcohol-related complications, here is a big part of the universal health care dialogue that has been largely ignored for the reasons we've already covered, that you know, it's a cost driver for the healthcare system. If we want to make healthcare more accessible and more affordable, we have to look at what's driving those healthcare costs.
And another thing, healthcare costs aren't just limited to the drinker. So
no, not even close. Of course, there's the mental health component to this for the family around the drinker, because, frankly, they're as ill as the person who has the addiction. But, you know, you look at the accidents that, just in terms of car wrecks alone, there's a lot of so-called innocent bystanders who got in the way of somebody who was driving, mixing gasoline with alcohol when they shouldn't have been. So there are a lot of other injuries that are caused by alcohol, not necessarily by the person consuming the alcohol.
And you mentioned car accidents, but in addition to that, how about the people that get shot by or get beat up by people who have had too much to drink? You hear about them every day.
It's a sad reality when we look at underage drinking. You know, we're always discouraging kids when they get their driver's license to stay away from drinking and driving. But the number one cause of illness and death, or injury and death, for teenagers that's alcohol-related isn't car wrecks, it's violence. That they're in the wrong place at the wrong time and they've been injured by or killed by somebody who was drinking, and not necessarily behind the wheel. You're right. It leads, the boy, there's a lot of discussion in domestic violence circles that alcohol does not cause domestic violence. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't cause it, but it sure as hell precipitates it in many instances. And in the case of where the violence may or may not have been, may not have been perpetrated, if the person wasn't under the influence, you know, you have to look at that relationship as well.
So in my chart, I put over on the risk side, leads to violence. And that's definitely a detriment, trying to make the decision, should I drink alcohol? Okay, so now what's next? I think we'll go into you giving us how alcohol is a cause of various things like cancer, heart disease, cirrhosis, stroke, and other things. How does alcohol cause cancer?
This is a known carcinogen. The Department of Health and Human Services has identified alcohol as a known, not suspected, human, not in rats or laboratory experiment, laboratory animals, but a known human carcinogen. It's directly linked, and when just follow the path it takes through the body. Number two cause of oral cancers in the United States, alcohol use. Esophageal cancer, cancer of the stomach, obviously the detriment it causes to the liver and pancreas, the colon. For women, this is the only dietary connection ever made to an increased risk of breast cancer, where one drink a day creates a double-digit increase in the risk of breast cancer for women. And four drinks a day increases the risk as much as smoking a pack of cigarettes a day. Now that's a substantial jump when we look at the cancer that is, first of all, it's not just limited to women, but it is so well known in the United States. And every October, we see pro football players or pro baseball players putting on pink parts of their uniforms to draw attention to this leading cause of cancer. And usually in those sporting events, the advertising is for beer. Name a brewing company, they got the ads for that. What a contradiction that is. But the cancer connection is very real. The challenge with cancer is that the younger you start drinking, you start your relationship with alcohol, the higher the risk is later in life. And how that works is your body is still developing. And this is especially true in the case of the risk of breast cancer. A young woman who starts drinking closer to her first period, between her first period and her first pregnancy, is going to have a higher risk because the body is still developing that breast tissue and you're already bathing it in a toxin and known carcinogen. So the risks for cancer for young people is much later in life. And this is the thing with all of these risks, these health risks. When you talk about the health risk of an opioid, you know, the cause and effect are pretty close to one another. You have too much of it, you're going to die, just like, you know, in the blink of an eye. In the case of alcohol, these things develop over time. So even a person who has been abstinent from alcohol for years or decades still has increased their risk later in life because of the damage that this toxin has done to the tissues. It's cumulative over time rather than having that immediate cause and effect that you see with opioids. But the cancer thing is really a difficult conversation to have because with Health and Human Services declaring this a known human carcinogen, then at the same time, the same agency says, here are our dietary recommendations for the government-issued dietary recommendations, and they're saying that if you drink, if you don't start, which is a good phrase they use. But if you drink, limit yourself to one drink a day for women and two drinks a day for men. Well, daily drinking is a sign of something bad anyway. They kind of skipped over that part of the conversation. But they're saying is one drink a day is okay when the oncologists say, that's crazy.
Well, for the people that are listening, imagine yourself going into the doctor's office and your doctor says, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have cancer. Do you know how emotionally distressful that pronouncement is to practically anybody who has it spoken over their life? And I'm thinking, if someone showed me a way that I could have a better chance of never having my doctor say that, I would do it. And you just told us of a better way of not having to come up with the diagnosis of cancer in your life.
We've had a long experience with cancer in our country, but especially a boom of it, so to speak, in the 20th and 21st century, and to the point of lowering our life expectancy here in the United States. We've had the first back-to-back reduction in our life expectancy. Some people will point to, well, we're losing a lot of young people as a result of the opioid crisis, but the numbers bear out that we are experiencing more cancers and more heart disease than ever before. Here in the United States, one of the so-called smartest countries on the planet, and we're consuming more alcohol than we ever have. Is there a cause and effect there? Absolutely.
Okay, so on your Benjamin Franklin T-chart, over on the risk part, you might put down causes cancer. Now, the second thing is heart disease. What is the relationship between drinking alcohol and increasing heart disease and death?
There's that old myth that drinking red wine is good for your heart, and as a physician, I know that you once heard that too. That was discredited more than 10 years ago. First of all, you look at who paid for that study, the wine industry, but get past that, and the relationship to alcohol and heart health. By the way, that wine study, it ties the health benefit to resveratrol, a substance that comes from the skin of grapes. Well, just eat the darn grapes, don't ferment them, because the alcohol in wine is very detrimental to the heart. First of all, alcohol raids the body of B vitamins, which are essential for brain health and heart health. But second, and most importantly, alcohol weakens muscle tissue. It's cumulative. It stacks up over time. So if we look at your body's most important muscle being the heart, you can see where alcohol is absolutely terrible for heart health. When we look at heart disease, we look at heart attack, both of those, the incidents go up. The more you drink, the higher the risk. My kid was listening to a radio program a few years back, and there was an advertisement for a public symposium put on by the University of Illinois Medical Center saying, Wine, Women, and Health. And I'm like, wait a minute, you just contradicted yourself here, because wine and women does not equal health. It's quite a bad combination when you talk about the heart risk and the, of course, the cancer risk that we just had a discussion about. So with the heart, though, you know, we look at observational studies, and that's kind of what this whole wine thing started out as an observational study. It wasn't evidence-based. Observational studies just tout the benefit of drinking the red wine without taking into the effect of other parts of their life. But the heart risks are pretty tremendous when you look at the incidence of heart disease. what causes heart disease, increase in cholesterol, what increases cholesterol, drinking alcohol, what increases heart disease, increase in blood pressure, what causes increase in blood pressure, alcohol. So the connections are pretty straight when you look at them. I mean, a lot of times you don't make those connections between cholesterol and alcohol use or blood pressure and alcohol use, but they're very real and they're underlying this whole threat to our cardiovascular system when it comes to even moderate consumption of alcohol.
So, on your little chart under risk, put causes heart disease. If you don't want to suffer a heart attack at a greater risk, you want to have a less risk of having a heart attack, don't drink alcohol. Pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's hit one, cirrhosis. Tell the audience how alcohol causes cirrhosis and therefore possible having to have a transplant of your liver, which is a very expensive operation. How does that happen?
Well, the liver is your body's main defense against putting this toxin through your bloodstream to begin with. So when alcohol enters the bloodstream, the toxin is reduced. It's broken down into a substance called acetaldehyde, which is 30 times more toxic than the alcohol itself. And then as the liver continues to break it down, it ultimately is expired from the, or excreted from the body in CO2 and water. But that means your liver is busy, busy, busy. And when it gets down to continuing to punish your liver, that's what you're doing by putting that alcohol in there. You're forcing the liver to work overtime, and as a result, your health deteriorates because this is your body's main defense against every toxin that it experiences. Cirrhosis, specifically, it's the gradual. Your liver is one resilient organ in your body. It is like a superstar. It's a rock star, and they're trying to keep you from your own vices, but it has limitations. And the cirrhosis being the most serious outcome, about 6,000 people a year in the United States die from alcohol-related cirrhosis of the liver, and then your liver just ends. It stops functioning. Before that, you get into a situation where you have a fatty liver, and that just means that your body has pushed aside the fat that the liver would automatically or ordinarily be conquering. It pushes it aside, and literally, it's right on the side or the outside of the liver while it's busy handling these toxins that you're throwing at it in the form of alcohol. Fatty liver disease is it's a precursor to cirrhosis. Neither of these things have symptoms until, well, your liver doesn't have nerve endings. If it did, you wouldn't take a second drink. But when your liver goes south on you, you don't know it until it's usually too late. You end up on a transplant list, and the list is unfortunately long, and people with a history of drinking or who are currently drinking aren't going to show up on the list of recipients.
So on your Ben Franklin chart under risk, put causes cirrhosis. Now we have other things that we can tell you about, and we will next week, but we're out of time for this show. And tell all your friends that you have found something that really is important for them to listen to and to come over to listen to these podcasts, because ultimately you can be saving their life. And the link that you use is www.freedomfromaddiction.libsyn.com. It will take you directly to this program, and you can find out about all the interrelationships between alcohol and your health and your life. Scott, it was great having you on the program again today.
And thank you, Wynn. I appreciate the opportunity. We've covered a lot of ground so far, and there's so much more to our dialogue to come.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate the fact that you're willing to take your time to do this, because you know how important it is to get the truthful information out to the public. And that's what we're trying to do, and we will continue this until we work through the whole problem. So thanks again for being on the show today. I'll see you next week.
Thanks, Wynn.